Hey, Mark, why don't you tell us about our brand new sponsor?
All right, Jeff. Funky Soul Coffee is a 70s-themed mobile coffee bar in a specially renovated 1975 Airstream trailer. The owners, Michelle and Gavin, have been renovating the Airstream themselves and are planning to launch later this summer. Their dream is to create a unique coffee shop experience that inspires you to reach for your dreams, too.
Welcome to Idaho History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right. This is Idaho History, and I am your host, Jeff Wade, sitting across the table from my wonderfully tanned co-host, Mr. Mark Iverson. What's up, Mark?
You know, just trying to get that suntan lotion off my skin.
You look really relaxed and ready to get back to work after your trip to Hawaii.
No, surely. Well, it was me and like 10 of my family.
That sounds rough.
In one house with my mother-in-law.
Yeah.
You know, I love my father-in-law. I love my mother-in-law. But it's an intense kind of relationship to be held within the same house in the roof for 10 days.
Certainly.
But it went well. Michaela and I, we boated alongside dolphins in this little motorboat raft thing, and I got blowholed by a dolphin. I don't know if that sounds sort of perverted. I don't mean it to be that way, but
did the dolphin like you? I don't know.
It just, it swam next to the boat, and I looked down, and then it right on my face.
Okay.
But it seemed to be just salt water, so I was a little worried that it was going to be gooey or grody.
Yeah.
It's not.
I had to pet a dolphin once at SeaWorld.
Oh, yeah. These ones you couldn't touch. They're like, do not touch the dolphins.
Right.
Wild
dolphins.
Can I punch a dolphin?
Okay.
Just kidding. Okay, all my friends listening out there, I would never punch a dolphin.
Please don't at PETA.
I know. I'd really like to hug a dolphin, but I think they can bite.
They're very intelligent animals, Mark.
Yeah, they can communicate with bubbles.
They're probably smarter than us. They could probably do this podcast for us.
Yeah.
I mean, but the microphones would get all wet, I guess.
Yeah. Right? But anyway, it was cool. They boated us into caves along the Nepali coast, where Jurassic Park, among other movies, was filmed.
Nice.
And then we went to a national park kind of thing, or a state park, where they boat you into a 1,000-year-old Hawaiian, fishing village, and there's remnants and everything from that. So it was pretty cool.
Well,
yeah.
Did you eat a lot of good food?
I had some Loco Moco, which is delicious Hawaiian food. It's like a fine gravy on two hamburger patties on top of rice. And with macaroni salad. It sounds like it shouldn't be good, but it's delicious. It's amazing, you know, but it's really interesting. History, Hawaii.
Well, now that we're all jealous of Mark's trip to Hawaii, we're going to ask a quick favor of all of you who are listening. If you could leave us a rating and review for our podcast, let us know how we're doing. Let your friends know how we're doing. Let everybody in the world know how we're doing with this.
Unless it's bad and you don't want to have anything good to say.
If it's bad, just send us an email. Like, here's the thing. Like, we've had some critical reviews, but no one's really been able to say anything about the history part of it. They just don't like us, I guess. So.
Oh, yeah, and I'm a neo-Marxist.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That is right. True, yeah.
Plight of the proletariat. And
all that. Oh, my gosh. Right. Yeah, there's some interesting people. But yeah, like, if you like what we're doing, if you have fun with us, please just ratings, reviews, you know, tell your mom, tell everyone.
Tell your Aunt Sally.
We're trying to make this thing as big as we can to, you know, tell people about Idaho history, which is awful and wonderful. But Mark, why don't you tell our listeners what we're going to talk about today?
Well, today, we want to start digging into some of the unique folklore of Idaho and how that folklore and history, where they intersect. We'll begin by defining folklore, and then we'll tell the tale of one Chief Bigfoot. And we'll break down the folkloric, elements of that story.
So I imagine us doing like a whole series of folklore here in Idaho. I want to explore some of the Basque folklore, and you know, I have a dissertation on the folklore of the Snake River Plain I need to get to. We'll talk about, you know, cryptids, one of my favorite subjects, and of course, oh, yes, the Wild Man of Idaho someday.
Oh, the Wild Man, yeah, there's lots to cover with the Wild Man, but yeah, we were on the Monsters, Myths, and Legends, was at the IPTV, or Idaho Public Television, show, and we studied all this folklore, and Jeff got all knowledgeable. Well, he was all knowledgeable, but he got, you know, even more knowledgeable and studied, researched the Idaho Wild Man, you know, or Wild Man of Idaho, and even more about wild men elsewhere. And
I think we both studied quite a bit on, you know, ghost, yeah, stories and, you know, different, again, cultures in Idaho. And
right, and yeah, we didn't even get a chance to really have that shine.
Yeah,
Jeff had all this stuff, but
it was a good experience.
It was a great experience.
I mean, they filmed us for like 2 hours, and
yeah, and you're gonna be on it again.
I am, actually. I recorded that last week. Can I tell you that?
Oh, shoot. That's right. You talked to the bigwigs at,
yeah,
Idaho Public Television.
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
I can't tell you what it's about or anything, but it'll be out next year.
Well, you can tell me when the...
You already know.
Oh, I do, don't I?
Yes, you do. Okay.
I can't. Whatever. Yeah, Jeff's going to be on TV.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You can check that out on their website, Monsters, Myths, and Legend. It was a cool episode. Actually, our old intern was on it as well, old Darren. Hi, Darren.
Darren, yeah, she talked about the Rathdrum witches, yeah, which we should definitely talk about later.
We should, yeah.
Like Halloween or something, but...
So, real quick, for this part of the first part of this episode, I'm going to refer quite a bit to Folklore and History, which is a paper by Henry Glassy, and that was published by the Minnesota Historical Society back in 1986. Glassy was one of the leading folklorists in the country at the time. My aim is to come up with some kind of a working definition of folklore and compare it to what we do as historians. Mark, why don't you hit us up with some definitions of folklore and of history so we can compare and contrast?
Well, sir, let me quote the fourth edition of the Cambridge Encyclopedia. Which defines folklore as the traditional songs, tales, proverbs, legends, and beliefs of a people. The same source lists history as the study of the past. Well, that's pretty basic, isn't
right,
it, Jeff?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mark, you're a trained historian. Would you agree with those definitions?
I mean, I guess in their most basic form.
Yeah.
It's bare bones as possible. You know, I mean, the traditional songs, tales, proverbs, legends, and beliefs of a people that, you know, weave us together, form our culture, inform one generation to the next, that change over time but remain the same in some key way. And in history, definitely, yeah, it's the study of the past. But, you know, what type of history are we talking about? Social history, you know? What do the masses, the grueling masses, as my neo-Marxist brain is telling me to say, how they fight the elite corporate kleptocracy? Is it kleptocracy? What's the money one?
Oh, where you steal money that you don't need?
Yeah, like the elite kind of group of ruling class individuals at the top. Is that theocratic?
Sure, I don't know.
Religious.
Again, yeah, you're the one with the book learning.
So, see, I'm no neo-Marxist. I'd know all that shit if I was a neo-Marxist. Anyway, yeah, I mean, so yeah, I agree with them,
in a basic sense. Yeah. So I'm going to paraphrase what Glassy says here. He says, history is true, folklore is false, insignificant, and oddly vital. See what he did there?
Mm-hmm.
Folk history is an oxymoron, a false truth. Legend, the genre through which folk history claims life, was once a falsehood believed to be true. Now, folk history is absurd because it holds no meaningful relation to the historian's chronicle of fact. The absurdity of folk history is nature as lie or lie-like is maintained by the careful preservation of legends in fragmentary conditions. The past is not history. History is the story of the past. Then at root, there is no difference between folk and academic histories. And Mark, that last line kind of haunts me a bit. What do you think he means there?
There's no difference between folk and academic histories. Let's see. I'm getting the feeling that I get what he's saying, where he's like folk memory, folklore, legend, those things. I see how he's saying those are not truths. They're distortions of the truth, or trying to explain real elements through fiction or fictional tales that people come to believe in many cases. I get that, right? And how that can't be history, but it can be a source of history. It is a source of history. Memory is a source of history. But he seems to be countering that in the end by saying there's no difference between folk and academic histories.
Yeah. I think with this passage, he's kind of making it purposely confusing, because these histories and folklores, they do intersect and intertwine so much. I don't think you can separate them.
Well, I think folk history is different than folklore. Folk history is like an oral tradition, perhaps, the tracking of a tradition, let's say in like Appalachia, or songs that, enslaved people would sing and come up with to keep their story going. Like, if that's folk history, then that's different from folklore, in my opinion.
Right.
Academic history is different in the sense that it's using a vast array of sources, citing those sources, and trying to logically arrange their ideas and their findings within some sort of essay or writing project. So I don't know what the hell this guy is saying.
It's very confusing. And I think, like I said, I think purposely so, because it's hard to separate these things.
Yeah.
I think honestly, like what we do, the stories we tell, the sources that we use, we kind of fall like somewhere in the middle of the two, right? Because we will use a lot of the, sources,
primary sources.
Well, yeah, we use a lot of primary sources, but
that's
then we'll,
academic practice.
We'll also use, stories that people have handed down through the ages, through their family line, or the story we'll talk about here in a little bit. It's been passed down through word of mouth for so long.
Yeah,
we also talk about that. We kind of blend those together.
So you always have to mention that these. This group of people are these witnesses to something. This is what they recall. And then oftentimes, if you can, you compare it to other sources or people's memories to present some sort of, picture of the event within the gray, not either. Some things are black and white, like last week's episode, the Aryan Nations fucking suck. That's pretty much a basic rule, right? We can all agree with that. So I don't know what this guy's definitely getting at, back to the folklore thing, but I look at folklore as a source of information for the telling of history, often cultural history, social history. Folk history is, yeah, I think you're right. We're somewhere in the middle, because we are packaging this for both crowds, really. Yeah. But we try to tell an entertaining yarn at the same time.
Exactly, yeah. So. But, as historians, try as we might, we do the best we can. Even if we're using good primary sources, we're never going to get everything 100% right and true as to the actual circumstances that we're talking about.
Right. It's not a science. And some people say it's a social science. You use source material and you quote that and come up with some sort of equation, if you will, that you tell through, but it's not in the sense, it's not in the sense of like, okay, well, grass grows because you give it water.
Yeah.
Right.
It's
and you plant it in dirt. That's a fact.
And you got to think most of the events and things that we talk about are witnessed by humans who write them down or tell their stories later on. Human memory is very fallible. It's never perfect. So,
well, like right now, Jeff could shoot me.
I could.
And that would be a crime. Well, yeah. But then there'd be the question of Well, why did he shoot him?
Right.
Did Mark do something? Didn't he do something? Is Jeff insane? Mark make him insane? Like, there's all these variables. And so that's what history is. You're trying to figure that out from people who lived hundreds, thousands of years ago, maybe.
Yep.
So anyway. Yeah. Yep. But really, what I'd like to say is basically, I don't know what the fuck this guy's talking about.
Okay. I thought it was an interesting way to get into this subject.
Yeah, it's an interesting quote if you can unpack it.
So, Mark, I was cruising Reddit the other night, and there's this post, and it was about, the headline of the post said, Idaho has no culture. And basically the poster was saying that Idaho doesn't have any kind of unique culture on its own. Like, it borrows from other areas, such as, you know, like northern Utah, Eastern Oregon, that type of thing. So let's kind of talk a little bit about culture, Mark. I think we'll tackle that maybe as an episode itself someday, but sure. Let's talk about folklore and culture a little bit.
Well, so Idaho, of course, has a blend of Native American, white European, Hispanic, and Basque culture.
And more.
It's
definitely not an exhaustive list.
No, not at all. And all of these cultures contribute to the folklore of the state. But it's also important to note that Idaho is not a continuous geographical area. It's divided by mountains, split into two time zones. Some of it's mountainous with beautiful forests, and some of it is an arid desert. Because of that fact, some people have difficulty grouping it into the Pacific Northwest. These divisions, of course, and the peoples who have settled in each area create their own variations on established folklore. A new folklore of their own.
And of course, the folklore that they do create isn't really penned in by geographical boundaries either. For example, people who have worked in the cattle industry in Idaho's Owyhee County have much more in common with people in Oregon's Malheur County, for example, than they would with people in Boise. Same with the descendants of the Mormons who settled the southeast of Idaho, having more in common with Utahns than they would people from Coeur d'Alene. Mark, can you think of any elements of folklore that might, you know, kind of transcend the whole state?
Jeez Louise, man.
Yeah.
Or culture,
anything, you know.
Well, yeah, okay, like certain tales, for instance. There's the whole Caleb Lyon thing.
Okay, yeah.
You know, that really goes a large chunk of the state, and it affected a large chunk of the state, and it speaks to the divide between the two. And
especially
there's
the whole capital moving from Lewiston to Boise, that whole story.
And, right. Yeah. There's a lot of fact to it, of course. You can reduce it to the historical, but as we joked earlier, like historical, hysterical, right? You can take it into the hysterical folklore realm, if you will.
Yeah.
Where it's like, no, you did it. No, we did it. No, you did it. You know, yeah, it's our state. No, it's our state. You know, we're the real Idaho. You're the real Idaho.
Right.
You know, like all these things. And you know, we were the real capital and you stole it. And it's like, you know, it goes into the realm of folklore, in my opinion.
Yeah, it really does. But, you know, Mark, our whole kind of shtick revolves around telling stories, right?
Yeah.
Whether it be, you know, the tours that we do, the books we write, you know, or this podcast. So you could say that in addition to being historians, we're also kind of like oral folklorists. For that reason, Mark, let's go and break down the types of oral folklore, if you would, please.
So there are fables, and these, you know, this tells a lesson or a moral. A legend is a traditional stories that are regarded as historical, but they're unauthenticated. Spoiler. That's the type we'll be talking about on the rest of this episode. Fairy tales usually has magical elements or the imaginary involved, like imaginary beings, mythic creatures. Myths, these are attempts to explain the natural world, like Odysseus's travels and the Adriatic, right?
Sure. I was thinking, you know, the Nez Perce have a lot of myths that help explain, you know, the creation of the world, stuff like that.
Right. Okay. tall tale, story with incredible elements related as if they were actually true. The story we have tonight can also possibly fit in here as well. So like maybe like John Henry's Hammer or Pecos Bill, stuff like that. Yeah. But like for legends, I'm thinking about, you know, the Alamo.
Yeah.
It's based in the truth, but it's become a legend.
It's been built up right. over the years.
And the facts are certainly not always in line with the way people tell that, or sure. Disney tells it in Billy Bob Thornton movies.
Yes.
You know.
So, Mark, before we move on to our actual story tonight, do you have anything, any other thoughts on, you know, folklore, culture in Idaho?
Yeah, no.
Excellent. And I'm sure by the time we're done with this, you'll have some more thoughts. So,
for sure.
You ready?
Yes.
All right, let's get on. We're going to talk about tonight, Mark, the legend of Chief Bigfoot. Now, we're not talking about our big, hairy Sasquatch friend.
No, sir.
Talking about Chief Bigfoot, and this is a story, man, this has been retold and told for the last, 100 and, I can't do math in my head very well, 150 years, 180 years, something like that.
1870 something?
Yeah, 1860s, 1870s, so, yeah,
so long time. What are we talking about? Is that Chief Howlick? Is that his real name, or is that...
We'll talk about him, yeah.
Okay,
all right. We'll get into that.
Sorry, I'm jumping the gun here, Jim.
You're good. So we've talked before about, you know, how the influx of white immigration on the Oregon Trail led to the conflict between immigrants and the native inhabitants of what is now southern Idaho and Oregon and Nevada, California, the whole region, right? Now, if you haven't heard our two-parter on the Snake War, go back and check that one out. I thought it was pretty good myself. I wrote it.
Do it.
Leading up to and during that so-called Snake War, there were many reports of wagon trains and livestock raids where, when the shooting was done, large footprints were found in the area.
And so these footprints were measured, and they were found to be up to 17 and a half inches long and 7 inches wide. You know what they say with folks with the, or chiefs with big feet, Jeff?
They wear big moccasins.
That's right, that's right, buddy. Well, that would be like a size 23 in today's men's shoe sizes.
Yeah, I couldn't find a chart that goes up to that size. So, like, I found like a calculator, and it just told me to have custom shoes made after that. I've tried it. How big were Shaq's or are Shaq's feet though?
Shoot, I think they're like
he's like a 22 or 23 shoe size.
I think he's bigger than that, maybe.
Yeah.
I had a buddy Ryan who. 7 foot, yeah, he was 7 foot center for our basketball team, then went on to play college ball at Minnesota and Wyoming.
Is this the one that got handcuffed to the pole at the Umatilla?
No, that's my friend Zach at the okay. Umatilla. Shout out Zach and Umatilla. But no, this was my buddy that he was just big, and I'd love to mess with him and then try to run away. Because it was an extreme sport. And he'd catch me sometimes and beat the crap out of me. But it was fun.
Good.
And he had those big feet that he'd stomp on me. But anyway, yeah, I think Shaq has larger feet than that. But maybe I'm wrong. But anyway, back to Chief Bigfoot and these raids. These footprints basically were found throughout southwestern Idaho, southeastern Oregon, northern California, and northern Nevada.
So, yeah, the native who left these giant tracks was soon dubbed Chief Bigfoot by the settlers, who swore he was the cause of any loss of livestock or other property. Basically, he was stealing everything that wasn't nailed down, right? One of the first mentions of this Chief Bigfoot was in the newspapers, and that comes from us from the Idaho Semi-Weekly World out of Idaho City on June 12, 1867. It mentions that Judge Watson's cabin down in Flint, which is about 10 miles south of Silver City, had been robbed, and two repeating rifles were among other items taken. And, of course, Bigfoot was supposed to be the thief responsible for this theft.
In October, Lieutenant Baker went to Fort Boise to Weezer to hunt down some natives. After clearing out a native camp, his soldiers found tracks nearby. According to the Idaho Statesman on October 15, 1867, one large track, not human by any means, made in many places plainly indicated that the famous Chief Bigfoot had been living in luxurious ease for some time in the vicinity. the dimensions of this delicate little imprint were taken several times, and the smallest measurement that could be obtained showed a length of 17.5 inches and widest breadth about 7 inches.
And the statesman continues, "This is no exaggeration, but actual fact," which you know it's true, right, if they say that?
Of course.
Yeah. "What a playful little creature he must be, poor Indian, so harmless." That's, I guess, sarcasm. Bigfoot is represented as a giant in stature and strength and has been reported killed on 3 or 4 occasions, but it seems the noble child of the forest still lives. Bigfoot is noted among his brethren for unapproachable skill in using the scalp knife on wicked white people. We are authorized to give $50 for the big toe of this babe of the woods, and his topknot would readily command $100 in coin. So that last part obviously indicates that a bounty was being offered for this Chief Bigfoot. And put a pin in that because we'll talk about how that's important later.
Well, so real quick, I do have to go back to 1818 or so when Donald Mackenzie and even, was it the Hunt Expedition with the historians, but Alexander Ross too, they said that some of the chiefs with the Boise Shoshone, Chief Payam, and I forget the other chief's name, were huge.
Right.
Giant men. And Donald Mackenzie, you know, in fact, was a really big Scotsman.
Yeah. Right?
And so I do know that there have been tales prior to this of, like, giant Indian chiefs, as we, quote unquote.
We told that story on our, what was it, Life and Death Along the Boise River episode, right. Which is pretty good.
I don't know if this is an exaggeration, you know, to make it seem more exotic in their journals.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know.
Or maybe it's like, oh, look what we face, what we went up against, you know,
right.
Type of thing.
You know, it's
building their own thing up.
So, again, I think there's basis of truth. Like, there were large chiefs that were actually there.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, in an area where the most athletic, the most skilled warrior would sometimes often become a leader.
Yep.
This would seem to make some sense, but right.
But then you get into like the whole giants of the, you know, that there were some, you know, giants of Native American origin or, you know, living during Native American times, and it's all kind of like conspiracy theory, like lizard people type stuff.
Right,
you know, it's kind of interesting to think about that too.
Well, so I do just real quick, then I'll get back to the topic at hand. There was a story I read about about the history of Dry Creek above Boise and Eagle, between those two, and how Chief Bigfoot ran through there. He's running away from the soldiers, and he just happens to stop and help some ranchers, farmers, put up a side of a barn because they were having trouble, and here comes Chief Bigfoot, pushes it up.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. It's like, oh, he's savagely killing all these people, but he helps this small group of people put up a barn, you know.
Why
but
not?
So back to 1867, though, at, you know, it was October 15th, wasn't it? 1867. But basically, 4 days later, the Statesman printed a letter dated October 7th. So just a few days before the footprint was found at Weezer, but the letter indicated that a rancher at the Dalles, Oregon, came back from his field to find his home ransacked. The army was alerted and they went out to search. They surprised Chief Bigfoot along with 22, quote, end quote, redskins who scattered when the soldiers approached.
On May 4th, 1868, Chief Bigfoot fought a skirmish with the army near Camp Scott in northern Nevada, killing one soldier and wounding others. Bigfoot was a terror of the western states, and soon he was responsible for almost every stagecoach robbery and wagon train attack. It was said that he had quite a stash of treasure from these robberies, some of which might still be buried somewhere down in the Owyhee Mountains, which was his favorite area. Which, there's like a whole buried treasure myth that's kind of built up around that.
And, yeah,
talk
quite
about
a few
more at the end. Yeah, Idaho has a lot of buried treasure stories.
Right.
Yes. However, Bigfoot's range was wide. The Dalles seemed to be the western edge of his territory, but he was also spotted as far east as Burley and Salmon Falls, and then south into Nevada, and maybe even as far north as up into the Nez Perce Reservation. his fresh tracks would often be found 75 miles away within a day of each other, despite the fact that he didn't have to ride a horse.
All right. Yeah, he could just run. Yeah. Yeah. So many descriptions of Bigfoot gave him, supernatural abilities. He could supposedly run faster than a horse. Maybe he had to rest on the horse. I don't know. But this allowed him to outrun the law and catch deer by the neck.
Wish I could do that.
I know, right? If I tried to, I could play. I think I could tag a deer on the neck, maybe. Mm. And then it would horn me. Or yeah. would gouge me with its horn.
Yeah.
But his method, or favorite method of killing, was to walk straight up to his victim, take his gun, and twist it into a pretzel with his bare hands, like in the old Looney Tunes. Like,
yeah. You know?
It was also said by some that he was part Indian and part beaver. The beaver part allowed him to swim back and forth across the Snake River at ease. That'd be a big beaver.
Right.
Right?
Oh, yeah. That's mm-hmm. a huge beaver.
Huge.
You know, when I was writing that, I originally had that line as mine, but I'm like, you know what? Mark needs to read the beaver line.
Why?
So you love beaver.
I know. It's one of my favorite rodents. The only rodent that's larger than the riparian beaver is the... Oh, crap. Now I forget it. It's that water-living thing in the app. Is a capybara. Capybara.
Yeah.
Yeah, and those things get mauled viciously by a great number of things in the Amazon.
Okay.
Bad place to be a rodent.
Yes.
Anyway, I digress.
So we talked about the physical descriptions, and these are interesting. Besides being 7 feet tall and about 300 pounds, one description of him says he was dressed only in a breechcloth from which dangled several blobs of rotting human flesh and hair. His own straight black hair hung around his face and shoulders, covering a handsome, strong-jawed face with wild blue eyes.
That wasn't the only thing swinging.
Okay. Hey-o.
Hey. But, you know, even before the newspapers existed in the area, we find accounts of Chief Bigfoot. Back in March of 1863, Standifer's Rangers, you know about him, Jeff.
I do.
Had come from the Boise Basin to fight the natives who were threatening the supply trains into the new mines. Led by Jeff Standifer, these men were miners and merchants who risked their lives and lost productivity on their claims. The Rangers fought a battle with the natives in the Mayfield area. It's a cool little ghost town.
Yeah.
Still out there, farm community. What is it, like just east of Boise?
Yeah, by the stitch shop kind of area.
Yeah, when they were fighting in the Mayfield area, they fought there, and then they came back to what is now the Warm Springs area of Boise.
I think it's the Warm Springs area of Boise. It just says Warm Springs, but that could refer to up in the Boise Basin as well.
Well, I'm thinking if it could be that, but so it could be the area now where the prison is, since that was known as a place where spiritually important place to the Boise Shoshone and the Shoshone. And also, it could mean the Warm Springs, perhaps, where the Warm Springs are there today, up by the springs at Idaho City.
Yeah.
Right? It could be one of those. Who knows? But, so it could be that. It could be those Warm Springs. But wherever, they stopped at a ranch owned by Beaver Dick. Yeah, so
Richard Dick Lay.
Yeah, actually, since it was in the East Valley, it could make a lot of sense that he stopped where Old Hot Springs Road was, right? Or the wagon tracks that led into what was early Boise City.
And Beaver Dick had a ferry in that area, so that would make sense, too.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But the Rangers discovered that all the livestock had been stolen by natives at Beaver Dick's. Beaver Dick got dicked by those natives.
He sure did.
Yeah.
Well, Beaver, he's a podcast episode, too. He's an interesting character.
Yeah, he is.
So after sending one of their wounded men back to Idaho City and gathering some supplies, the Rangers went south to the Snake River, where they split in half. Standifer led his contingent west to the Malheur, while two lieutenants were placed in charge of the other. This group went east along the Snake River, and they camped near Salmon Falls, near the present-day city of Hagerman. Now, according to T.J. Sutton, the chief scout for this contingent of Standard Fraser Rangers, they set up camp so the scouts could go out and look around for native encampments.
But the natives found them by accident. Unaware of the presence of the white men's camp, a group of natives attempted to drive a herd of stolen livestock across the river just below camp. When they heard the splashing, the rangers went to arms and took up firing positions on the riverbank. When the natives reached mid-river, the command to fire was given.
Now, this could have been a good chance for the rangers to capture many horses and kill lots of natives, but the excitement and lack of training prevailed, and the rangers failed to catch or kill the thieves. But after the shooting was done, Sutton and the scouts set out about tracking the natives, following the footprints that had been left behind. They were startled to find that one of the sets of prints was quite larger than the others, measuring 17 and a half by 6 inches.
By God, that's Chief Bigfoot right there, Jeff.
Oh, yeah.
So Sutton's report comes to us via John Haley's book, The History of Idaho, published in 1910. While writing this book, Haley interviewed or received letters from the people who lived through the events. Sutton's letter to Haley mentioned that at the time, the rangers had not yet heard of Chief Bigfoot, but they were in awe of the size of the tracks they found. Sutton laments that had they had better leadership, they would have been able to capture Chief Bigfoot then and there. For more on Standifer's Rangers, please see Jeff's book, Brave as a Lion, Jeff Standifer and the Knights of the Golden Circle. And I've read your first version, at least more than half of it, and it's good. I enjoy it.
Well, I'm excited
to read your second edition.
Yeah, so it's actually on sale for $10 off on Amazon for the hardcover right now, but the Amazon's raising their print costs, so that price will go up on, I think, the 20th of June. So get it now, please. Or it's on Kindle. That price isn't going to go up.
Do it.
Anyway.
Jeff is a local author. Support Jeff.
Yes, please. I would appreciate it.
Right.
Sutton closes that part of his account by mentioning that Bigfoot became famous a year or two later for raiding ranches and basically stealing anything that wasn't nailed down by the settlers. Those are my words, not his. But that was until 1868, when Chief Bigfoot was killed by a man named John Wheeler.
Huh. Okay, that was unexpected. Wheeler first encountered the elusive Bigfoot near the bank of the Malheur River. He was camped with two other men, one named Cook and one named Frank Johnson. During the night, their horses had been spooked by something, and when they had enough light in the morning, the three men searched around, finding a set of giant footprints. They knew the Chief Bigfoot was about.
The men knew about Bigfoot through a man named Enoch Throot. Mark, you've heard that dude, right?
Yeah, it's a crazy name.
He was the closest thing to a friend that Bigfoot had among the white men. Throot ran the ferry at Farewell Bend on the Snake River, which was basically ran between Huntington, Oregon and Weezer, Idaho, roughly. He often traded with Bigfoot, and because of him, it became known that the native actually spoke English and was not actually Bannock or Shoshone or Paiute, like we would assume, but from some other tribe. Throot was an interesting character because he was also a well-known horse thief, and I might be putting together a blog post or something on him soon because he's got some interesting stories.
You run into a lot of these interesting people when you are looking into somebody else.
Yes.
But Wheeler, Cook, and Johnson, after finding the tracks, ate a quick breakfast, mounted their horses, and took to the trail. A hard ride brought the three white men in sight of Bigfoot and two native companions. And they were headed toward the Snake River, catching up to the natives who were on foot. The white men shot down Bigfoot's two braves, but the chief escaped the first skirmish. Bigfoot was almost a mile away before the men realized, and as they spurred their horses on, they watched in awe as the chief handled the rough terrain with ease on foot.
For 30 miles, they chased Chief Bigfoot all the way to the bank of the Snake River. Bigfoot jumped in, swam to the opposite bank, you know, that beaver power,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then he stopped on the other bank to taunt his pursuers. And he said, come on over, you damned cowards, in perfect English. And then he disappeared into the willows. The men and their exhausted horses were forced to make their way 5 miles to the nearest ferry and then back to the spot where they lost sight of their prey. Finding his telltale footprints, they tracked him all the way to the mouth of the Weezer River, where they found a makeshift camp with a cold fire and two salmon carcasses.
After examining the salmon bones that had been picked clean, they realized that Bigfoot had backtracked and followed his prints all the way back to the Snake River. Bigfoot had swum back across the Snake and was probably long gone. The tired men couldn't help but cuss the native that had outwitted and outran them. Wheeler was especially pissed. He vowed that the next time he came across Bigfoot, it would be the end of that particular giant Native American.
Apparently,
and
he
didn't say it in those terms.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm sure he used different language. Apparently, the reason he was so mad, because during this whole thing, he had ruined a good horse. Well, whatever that means. I'm not a horseman, but...
What's he doing with that horse? Well, oh, am I getting that wrong?
Both of them were pretty tired afterward.
Yeah, right.
Whatever happened there. Mm-hmm. But Wheeler would get his wish 2 years later. But, you know, the world wouldn't find out about Bigfoot's demise until about 10 years after it happened. On November 14th and 16th, 1878, the Idaho Statesman published a letter in two parts from a man named William T. Anderson, who had been working as a carpenter in Silver City back in 1868. I don't know. Are you tracking that?
Yeah.
Okay. So the letter was in 1878, but the events that he was writing about happened 10 years before in 1868.
Remembrances.
Anderson mentioned in his letter that he recalled being there during the Owyhee War, in which two rival mining companies fought an underground battle on War Eagle Mountain. We briefly mentioned that in our Magruder episode, but we'll do a full episode on that, because that's fascinating
crazy
story, too.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. So Anderson mentions that Governor Ballard sent men from Boise City to Silver City to help quell the unrest. One of these men was a tall, fine-looking young man of rather slight but handsome build. He had dark brown hair and a smooth face, with dark steel-gray eyes, expressive of intelligence, and a kind heart. Anderson was introduced to this man, who turned out to be John Wheeler. Wheeler and Anderson hit it off and spent a lot of time together. I bet. Up in the mountains, tending sheep.
We don't judge.
We don't. They even went together on a prospecting trip and mined near each other.
Anderson's description of Wheeler goes on and on and on, but here's a little bit more of it. Quote, a good-hearted fellow and was the life of the camp and every circle into which he came. He was one of the bravest and most determined men in the territory. He was as strong and active as a panther and a better... and a better marksman than any man he ever met in his life. Again, there's a lot more, but we don't want to be here all night.
Jeff, if I had a nickel for every time I called you a panther, I'd have no money.
It's quite a description.
Right. In July of 1868, Anderson says he was headed from Silver City to Boise, driving a two-horse wagon. He was alone and unarmed. You know, that sounds... Knowing the area in that time, that's pretty dumb.
This is, like, right at the end of the Snake War, so it's pretty active still.
And I found that even if you had a gun, you could be screwed rather easily.
Yes.
Yeah. But as he approached an area he knew to be dangerous, he decided to stop his wagon and let his horses graze a bit until another party came along, you know, that he could travel with for protection. He let his horses free of the wagon, and while he was engaged in other business, the horses took off towards Reynolds Creek.
I don't know if that means he was pooping or what was going on.
No, who knows, but I know you don't take your horses lightly. You keep them around.
But he followed the horses to the creek, but decided to turn back toward the road before he was able to catch them. When he did, he came across a chilling sight. Three Native American warriors, painted and feathered, running right at him. He realized one of them was about 7 feet tall and running much faster than his two companions. Anderson scrambled behind some rocks, and as he did, something else caught his attention.
It was the Silver City stage, and it was what Bigfoot was after. Bigfoot started sprinting, with his two braves right behind him now, but suddenly the crack of a rifle caused one of them to fall. Anderson looked around but could not see the shooter. Bigfoot also heard the shot and ducked into some weeds near the road. A second shot took down the other warrior, and Anderson watched as Bigfoot's attention was drawn to a clump of willows. Bigfoot was on the move, trying to flank the area where it seemed the shooting was coming from.
After a few minutes of this, a voice rang out saying, "Get up from there, Bigfoot, you old feather-headed, leather-bellied coward. I can see you crawling off like a snake. This is one time you did not even get a woman's scalp. Here's a scalp. Come down and get mine, you coward."
Bigfoot jumped up from his hiding place, leveling a double-barreled rifle at the willows, calling out, "You coward! Me no coward! You come out! I'll scalp you too!" With that, John Wheeler stepped out of the willows, replying, "Here I am, now sail in, old rooster." Cock-a-doodle-doo.
Yes. Old-timey language. It's great. I know. But with that, both men started firing at the same time. Bigfoot staggered, but was able to get another shot off. His gun was empty. He ran toward one of his dead companions, but was hit by another shot as he scooped up the dead warrior's rifle. Bigfoot was able to use that gun to fire off one round, but then he was hit again. He then drew a knife and started running at Wheeler, but Wheeler kept firing, striking Bigfoot almost every time.
Bullets poured into Bigfoot's body, but he didn't stop until one shot shattered one of his legs and he fell to the earth. Wheeler reloaded his rifle and taunted his opponent some more. Bigfoot replied, "Don't shoot me anymore. You have killed me." Wheeler then acknowledged Anderson's presence, calling for him to come over. Bigfoot asked for water, but before he would let the chief have a drink, he felt it necessary to further disable him.
Wheeler then shot Bigfoot in his good arm, adding to the 12 wounds he had already inflicted on the man. Only then was Wheeler comfortable with giving his adversary a drink from a flask containing alcohol and ammonia. Good combination, right?
Right.
It's a cocktail that we often enjoy. After some time, Bigfoot started to talk. First, he asked that Wheeler not take his body to Boise City when he died. He asked instead that his body be placed in the willows with some rocks on top and his old gun beside him. He told Wheeler that if he granted his wish, he would tell him where he came from. Wheeler agreed, despite that $1,000 bounty offered at Fort Boise.
Huh. That sounds quite, I don't know, what's the word, advantageous to Wheeler.
Right.
But Bigfoot's story was pretty incredible. He said that his real name was Star Wilkinson, and he was half Cherokee, half white and half black. Just kidding, he was half Cherokee, quarter white and quarter black. But he had grown up in the Cherokee Nation. As a child, he always had big feet, which other kids made fun of. Wilkinson, slash Bigfoot, started drinking and he got into many a fistfight. He decided that before he got killed in a fight, he would run away. In 1856, he fell in with an immigrant train headed to Oregon country.
He fell in love with a young white woman, but she had another suitor who was an artist from New York. That artist made fun of Bigfoot. So near the Goose Creek Mountains of southeast Idaho, he killed the artist while the two were looking for the train's stock. Now a fugitive, Bigfoot did not return to the train, but struck out on his own. He made his way to the Boise River, where he met another, quote, half-breed named Joe Lewis, who was known to be the instigator of the Whitman Massacre.
Huh. Okay. Not the boxer, Joe Lewis. That came later.
Yeah.
Lewis, Bigfoot, and a band of 30 natives later tracked down the white woman he had fallen in love with. They caught up to the wagon train and slaughtered it, ravishing the young woman before killing her. Damn. The way he describes his massacre might indicate that he was referring to the Ward Massacre on the Boise River. Oh, that, yeah. Mm-hmm. That makes some sense, although that would have been 1854.
Yeah.
But he might be off in his time period.
Exactly.
But he implicated himself in several other massacres and the murder of Michael Jordan. Man, damn it. The man who was first to find gold in the Owyhees, as well as the murder of an army officer from Camp Lyon and his pregnant wife, right?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. We talked about them at the end of our Snake War episode part two. Again, Jeff wrote that. Go listen. Please do it now. But anyway, Sarah Ann Arnold Denoil?
I think
we talked about this.
Yeah, I think we pronounced it Denali? I can't remember.
Yeah, but Arnold had been killed and Sarah was taken, never to be seen again.
And of interest to me, Mark, Bigfoot told Wheeler, quote, "I had a squaw for a wife, and when Jeff Stanford was out with a lot of men fighting us, they killed my wife and carried off my little boy." No doubt he meant Jeff Standifer, who had in fact carried a little boy from his fight on the Malheur River back to Idaho City, was given to the violinist John Kelly. The boy became a contortionist and the pair toured Europe together. And then this actually is backed up in 1938 when a man named Dunham Wright, who was then 96 years old, told the Idaho Statesman that he had been with Standifer's Rangers and knew that the child given to John Kelly was in fact Bigfoot's son.
Oh,
interesting connections there, right?
Right. After giving his confession, Bigfoot died. Anderson happened to have a measuring tape and decided to record Bigfoot's measurements. All of them?
Yelza.
Yeah. Well, he was supposedly 59 inches around the chest, 6 and 8.5 inches tall. Foot length was 17 and a half inches, 18 inches around the ball of his foot, and 18 inches wide hands. Then Anderson Wheeler carried out Bigfoot's dying wish and buried him by Reynolds Creek. Wheeler broke Bigfoot's rifle on a rock and left the pieces atop Bigfoot's grave. Okay, don't take me back to Boise and get all the laurels
right.
and glory. I'm just going to hide the most infamous chief in the area under some rocks and some willows.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds legit, right?
Yeah, it does.
Well, I mean, if you were Bigfoot, you wouldn't want to be taken back to Boise because you don't know what they were going to do with your body. Probably hang it from a post or something.
True, but I'm more... That makes a lot of sense. And then how they would bury, you know, in the area a lot of time, use rock crevices or, mm-hmm. you know, pile stones atop your body. That piece fits, but I discount the white man's version of this because I know that that rarely happened.
I'm glad you do because we'll talk about that some more. But that's the end of the story, as far as it's told, but not really. Anderson saw Wheeler in Boise City 3 days later. Wheeler was well-dressed and talking to some gentlemen, apparently not telling these gentlemen about the killing of Bigfoot. Wheeler never tried to collect on the bounty, nor did he ever tell anyone about how he killed the most legendary wagon train robbers in the West. However,
John Wheeler was a career criminal himself. Back in 1859, he killed a man named James Lilly on the banks of the Santiam River in Oregon. He was arrested for a series of stage holdups in the Blue Mountains not too long after Bigfoot's death. The gang's undoing was when Wells Fargo received word that Wheeler and his gang were getting ready to rob one of their stagecoaches near La Grande. So they switched out the gold in the treasure box for lead. Wheeler had been representing himself as a U.S. Marshal from Boise during this time. The road agent stopped the stage, took the box, and lit out into the country to divide the loot. Finding the lead, and probably figuring the authorities were onto them, the gang split up and Wheeler went back to Boise, where he was arrested on August 30th, 1868, by Marshal Alvord and Rube Robbins, the legendary lawman. Chuck Norris of the Idaho Territory.
On his way to Portland to stand trial, he was able to escape by jumping out of the stagecoach, which was moving full speed, and he was shackled to one of his co-defendants. But the two men were later captured, and Wheeler was sentenced to 8 years in prison, which he served about 8 of those years. I'm not sure why, but he did his time at San Quentin. But that doesn't really make sense to me because Oregon had its own state penitentiary at Salem, which is still in use and has been since 1863. Maybe because of his history of escapes. I'm not sure. Maybe federal time. I did find one newspaper article saying that orders actually came from the U.S. Secretary of the Interior to move him to California. So it's kind of one of those weird things.
Well, Wheeler put his time in prison to good use, learning how to do dental work. Upon his release in 1877, he moved to Mendocino and opened a dental practice, calling himself Doc the Dentist. That's what you want to see. You're like, dentist, doctor, where do your credentials come from? Prison.
San Quentin.
You're my man, doc. But anyway, so Wheeler married and everything seemed like he was living the straight life until October 1879 when he was arrested for planning a robbery, which ended in a shootout that left two men dead. While awaiting trial, he escaped from jail, leaving behind a note for the sheriff explaining that he was innocent of the crime. Oh, well, everything's forgiven then.
Yeah. He was once again recaptured a short time later and sent back to the jail. But Wheeler was convicted of the murder in a sensational trial. Wheeler stood up in court and gave an impassioned speech about his innocence in the crime. It didn't really do anything for him because he was sentenced to be hanged on July 2nd, 1880, but Wheeler had other plans. The day after the sentence was handed down, Wheeler's wife visited him in jail, bringing him a lethal dose of morphine. When it was discovered that he was overdosing, all efforts to save his life were made, including pumping his stomach. He lingered for 9, I can imagine, pretty painful hours. But on May 15th, 1880, John Fleming Wheeler died by his own hand, avoiding the noose.
Part of me's like, damn, dude, try to escape first and then resort to the morphine.
But every time he did, they got him. They captured him again.
I know, but...
But my thing is like, why go that very painful overdose route when you could just have your neck snapped cleanly? And
well, if that's if, how it
yeah,
went.
That's true.
But we know. But, you doesn't know, always actually, work that way. Morphine... Isn't it supposed to make you feel good?
I don't know if you're overdosing on it, if it would feel good.
I don't know. I've never overdosed on it.
Maybe we should try it. Kids, but, don't do drugs.
Yeah, don't do it. According to an obituary in the Petaluma Courier, May 26, 1880, Wheeler was born in Arkansas in 1843. His father took him to California as a young man, or as a young boy, actually. But returned east at 9 years old when he was captured by the Sioux and spent 3 years among them. He ended up back in California, then came to Idaho during the Salmon River Gold Rush in 1863. In 1867 and 68, he served as undersheriff of Idaho County and later as a deputy under the first U.S. Marshal of Idaho.
Which I wasn't able to confirm that anyway, so I don't know if that's true or not.
It also mentions that his father was a dentist, which is where Wheeler learned the trade, and that he was a good writer, saying he was an observer and analyst above his class. And the crisp way he presents his thoughts is often striking, whose power over man was remarkable. Well, perhaps he should have lent his talents to other pursuits.
Well, he was good at robbing, though.
Apparently not.
If you're good at something, you stick with it.
Apparently not, though.
But among the items left behind in his cell were several letters, handwritten musings about his life. In these letters, he once again declared his innocence, thanked his attorney, and his wife for their support. I mean, his wife gave him a lot of support because she gave him the drugs to kill him, right?
Right.
Thanks, hon. And he swore that his ghost would haunt the prosecutor.
If I ever get in a jam like that, I'm going to say that.
That's going to be my will. It's going to haunt everybody. Other papers had musings that he had written about his life. What was missing from these writings was any mention of his killing of Chief Bigfoot. Also, it seems that Wheeler didn't like to talk about Bigfoot. There is only one account of him speaking about it, and that was when an old friend asked him about it specifically. And Wheeler told him he remarked in his quiet way that he had a little matinee with some Indians he was looking for, and that the air of the mountains Bigfoot would not trouble anybody hereafter. He also never collected on that $1,000 bounty that we talked about. Mark, that's over $22,000 today.
I think I'd be collecting on that.
I could use $22,000, yeah.
So that's John Wheeler's life. Let's talk about the other man who was present when Bigfoot was killed. Remember we mentioned William T. Anderson, who wrote the letter to the Statesman in 1878 describing how Wheeler killed Bigfoot. Anderson mentioned that he was writing the letter from Fisherman's Cove, Humboldt County, California. And at the time of the incident, he was living and working as a carpenter in Silver City.
Huh? The problem with that is there are no records of a William T. of a William T. Anderson living in either place. Local researchers down in California have looked for any records there and have come up with bupkis. I also looked using the tools that we have available to us, and Anderson just does not seem to exist anywhere. So who then wrote the letter about Bigfoot's confession?
Wheeler. Well, most likely it was John Wheeler himself, right? So a folklorist named J. Sanford Raccoon, well, that's a crazy name, wrote an essay called The Narrative of Chief Bigfoot, A Study in Folklore, History, and Worldview, which appears in the book Idaho Folklife, Homesteads to Headstones, edited by Louis W. Atterbury. Raccoon makes a lot of good points on why Wheeler was probably the author of the Anderson letter. Just prior to the letter being published, Wheeler had moved to Mendocino County, which is right next to Humboldt County, where the letter was supposed to have been sent from.
You know, Mark, I think he was actually living in Ukiah, which kind of was a weird connection to our last episode on the Aryans, because they did some violence there, right?
Yeah, right.
Weird, huh? Also, the whole letter reads basically like a love letter from Wheeler to Wheeler, with the way it describes his heroic deeds and actions. And remember, Wheeler was said to be a very good writer and a very boastful person who was not afraid of a good lie. It's also interesting that both Wheeler and Star Wilkinson slash Bigfoot were both from the Cherokee Nation and happened to be half Cherokee, and they were both accused stagecoach robbers. It's like Wheeler was patterning the Star Wilkinson story off of his own life.
As far as the events and people mentioned in Bigfoot's confession, these were all very well known around the West at the time. In fact, it seems that each was cherry-picked for certain details to make the story more plausible. Even Bigfoot was patterned after a real person, a man we talked about a bit back in our Snake War episode. Chief Howlick, who led a band of Shoshone in several attacks on white settlements, was also said to be very large, with big feet. And when General George Crook arrived to fight the Snake War to a close, it was with Chief Howlick that he fought his last engagement.
But Howlick wasn't killed by Wheeler in 1868, we know this for sure. He was one of the leaders who eventually decided on peace and surrendered himself, along with his band, to the military. Howlick lived the rest of his life on the reservation, and I think he went to the Umatilla Reservation, I'm not sure. I will also say that it is interesting that Wheeler, or whoever wrote the letter, chose 1868 as the Bigfoot was killed, as this coincides with the close of the Snake War and the majority of hostilities between natives and whites. Someone reading the account who had lived in the area during that time might have been fooled to think it was Wheeler's actions and not, you know, several companies of cavalry and infantry that brought safety to the settlements.
And it's well known that while in the Umatilla area, Howlick went to the Umatiddy.
That's true.
Yeah. It's the oldest, there often? Right, it's the oldest strip club in the world. But the Bigfoot story has become pervasive in folklore of the southern Idaho region. In addition to the historic sources we have already mentioned, the Bigfoot letter was also reprinted in Elliott's History of the Idaho Territory. Very cool book.
It is. Yeah. The illustrations are awesome.
Awesome. I don't know so much about the history, but I think a lot of it's...
Yeah.
It describes people and places, right?
Yeah.
But many people reading it in a history book probably took it at face value and believed it to be 100% true. But Jeff, if most of this Bigfoot stuff is made up, how do you explain the giant footprints that were found all over the country?
There are a couple possible reasons the settlers were finding large footprints. First, in the winter, it was common practice to stuff moccasins with sagebrush, juniper, or other plants for insulation, which of course would make the footprints look larger.
Right.
Also, though, it seems that the tribes might have had large moccasins made up to leave those footprints as a way to intimidate their enemies. It was said that right after the outbreak of the Bannock War, the Nez Perce found large footprints up in their territory, supposedly left by the Bannocks to scare them. This led to the Nez Perce coming up with the saying, quote, "Even small Bannocks can have big feet."
And not everyone from the time period that Bigfoot was allegedly terrorizing the countryside was convinced of his existence. From the Idaho Statesman, I'll quote it, August 13th, 1868. It's a titled, what, Big?
Big, that's the headline, Big. Yeah,
Big. Mr. J.A. Landis, who accompanied Colonel Sinclair's expedition as guide, sends us a note accompanying a pair of large or huge moccasins, which were taken from some of the Indians over on the Salmon. They measure about 16 inches long by about 6 inches wide, and when stuffed with rags or fur and a common size foot, would make a fearful looking track in the sand or mud. Landis thinks this one pair of moccasins and the knowledge of the manner in which they were or are worn is enough to dispel Bigfoot, the Bigfoot myth, which has gained such extensive circulation. He thinks that a very moderate sized Indian with some skill could make a track with these moccasins, which a man with a little bad whiskey in him would swear was made by an Indian 7 feet tall, or 17 feet tall. I like that, with a little bad whiskey.
So I think that pretty much puts to rest the whole Bigfoot Indian, right? Big Indian tracks, at least.
Right, right.
But Bigfoot and his son Littlefoot were again killed in 1884, this time in New Mexico. A rancher made spurs out of their jawbones. Oh, wait, no. Did we mention that Littlefoot had been killed back in 1867 during that same battle that Sergeant O'Toole lost his life that we talked about back in the Snake War episode?
Oh, right.
I'm, you know, I'm being a little bit facetious, of course, but it's clear that there really was no Bigfoot, at least not this mythical one that we have been, you know, talking about. Even so, Mark, a lot of people out there still believe that Bigfoot was real. Now, we stopped, it was a couple weeks ago now that we stopped at Walcher's Ferry down on the Snake River. And, you know, that's basically between Napa and Murphy on Highway 78.
Right.
There's this monument shaped like the state of Idaho, is put there by the Sons and Daughters of Idaho Pioneers. And it lists some of the events that happened in the area. And one of them was Wheeler's killing of Chief Bigfoot in Reynolds Canyon. And then also here in Southern Canyon County, there's a Bigfoot road down there. So, you know, Bigfoot, the story is, you know, obviously out there, and a lot of people know it. A lot of people retell it.
And of course, there is that insert preposition. I suppose
you can do it either way.
And of course, there's that creative statue of Chief Bigfoot at Old Fort Boise, the replica in Parma. Apparently, when it was dedicated, there was a pageant put on by locals depicting Bigfoot's alleged role in the Ward Wagon Train Massacre, which nobody describes anything, you know, any of the survivors as some massive, you know, chief. Right. But then again, they were on horses a lot, and you wouldn't necessarily see that.
But again, like you said, the timeline doesn't match up for that either.
Right.
Because he didn't come out 2 years after the Ward Massacre.
There's a lot of hogwash surrounding this man's story.
One thing that I forgot to put in the script, well, actually I didn't find it until he's done writing the script, Mark. I sent you that little article from the paper, The Statesman, about Wheeler's treasure up in, supposedly hidden up in the Boise foothills, right?
Yeah. Remember that? Oh yeah, 5 miles back from like the Ford area or something.
So okay, like Chief Bigfoot supposedly had treasure hidden in the hills, Wheeler supposedly had treasure hidden in the hills. So it's like he was using the Bigfoot story to tell his own story.
Right.
Like, I think, you know, he didn't want to confess to all these stagecoach robberies and stuff that he did. So he just used the Bigfoot story as kind of his own creative outlet to tell his story through Chief Bigfoot's.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. It's perfect folklore.
It is.
A smattering of truth with a lot of bullshit.
That's right. So one last thing I want to mention, and, you know, there was more that I could say, but again, I found a lot more on this story than I thought I would. You know, that happens almost every time we sit down to write a story out, right? But I want to mention the legend of Chief Nampa, which is a story that almost always gets intermingled with the Bigfoot legend. And I guess it makes sense because both names supposedly refer to the size of a Indian chief's foot.
Right. And we talk about him.
We have talked about him. Yeah. Back in our Nampa, or on our Mythbreakers episode. But we talked about how that was basically, Chief Napa was basically a whole fabrication of a man named Fred Mock for the Napa Harvest Festival. Yet still, people are going to believe that both Napa and Bigfoot were both real, or maybe possibly the same person. But I think the takeaway from this story is that it's so easy for folklore and history to intermingle with each other. The legendary chief Bigfoot and Howluck are forever intertwined, as is the real figure of John Wheeler and that legendary one that he possibly created in his Bigfoot confession legend.
And we see how these things form, you know? Yeah. Like now, especially with movies and, you know, John Wayne swinging his musket at all the Mexicans, taking down like 20 of these suckers before he's taken down. When, in fact, the truth is, Davy Crockett fought a hard fight, but in the end, you know, he was executed.
Right.
You know, Jim Bowie, you know, in bed, you know, with his pistols, but yeah. He had a severe disease. I forget which disease, but he was probably just laying there and he was bayoneted. You know, I mean, and then Travis was killed pretty much outright. William Barrett Travis was killed pretty much outright in the battle, right? But there is some truth there, too, you know? I mean, and I think there's a lot more truth to the Alamo legend as there is to, you know, Bigfoot. Right. But it just shows you, you know, like, even in present day, with a lot of information and sources and witnesses, legend still starts to form, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And... yeah, I think in this case, you have more BS than you have truth, you know.
A little bit of truth, a lot of BS.
A lot of BS for, you know, and that's what I was thinking of William McConnell in this. You know, I would also say there's more truth in his story, but definitely floated his own boat.
Yeah,
he did. Look all good.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah, I really enjoy his writings, but I have to take him with a grain of salt, especially when he's talking about himself in the third person.
Right. But, you know, writing was like that back in the newspapers, memoirs, whatever. It was, you know, the Penny Dreadfuls to the, you know, Tales of Billy the Kid that came out later, you know, but those, that writing was flourishy.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Tombstone, Wyatt Earp and the his writers, The Last Ride or whatever, and then Doc Holliday, the legends are way better than the truth sometimes.
It's true.
You know.
And I think a lot of it comes down to is who's going to buy a newspaper if, you know, the writing's boring and flaccid to speak, you know.
Well, papers are naturally flaccid.
Right, it's true.
Yeah. They're not very crisp.
Yeah, starch them. but, yeah, no one wants to read that kind of boring, just news copy writing. They want, you know, the excitingness. That's how you sell books and newspapers.
I mean, shit, we're still doing it.
Well, we don't do that.
With no, I mean with news.
It's true.
You know, like everything's breaking news, even when it's not on CNN or, you know, just sensationalism sells. So a lot of times what you're watching on many a network, unless it's PBS, and PBS is boring, but it's also good news.
Yeah.
Because it's boring. Some of it's interesting, you know, but... you know, you watch any pundit on I'm going to say Fox News, I'm going to say MSNBC. Mm-hmm. Maybe you agree with them, maybe you don't, but that's not news.
Right.
Right? It's punditry.
It's a lot of just people talking out their necks just because it's the whole 24-hour news cycle and they have to get it out there. They have to have that little competition with the other ones.
Yellow journalism during William Randolph Hearst's time, you know, prompting us to...
in the Spanish-American War.
Yeah, right. And he's working with Roosevelt and his ilk in New York and Washington, D.C., that want a war. They want to prove the kind of, like, imperialism of the United States against the other, you know, colonizers, nations. And, you know, that's the power of news. And we're in one of those time periods where news is making us riled up. But I feel bad for historians... 100 years, 150 years from now, trying to figure out what the hell we're doing, you know, and who knows what it's going to be like then.
You know, like there's times where we can't find the sources we want, but then there's other times where it's just a deluge of sources and they don't agree with each other. And that's just as hard as not finding the sources that you need.
Oh yeah. That's really difficult.
I would love to actually maybe interview, maybe Nate Eaton, who covered the Lori Vallow trial, guy like that, and kind of help us maybe sort out some of this stuff and like how journalists approach things these days and how they maybe how some of them do try to make sure just the real story is being told.
It's to be a journalist or a historian, academic, sociologist, whatever, right now, is a difficult thing to be because people want what they want it to be.
Yep.
And it rarely is what they want it to be. But there's some truth in what they want it to be, but there's a whole lot of bullshit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, I guess. There is.
You know, back then it had real ramifications for the Snake Indians that were being fought, I would imagine.
Yeah. Mark, I have this theory, and I haven't told you this theory, I don't think, but I have this theory that the...
Aliens killed JFK.
No.
Oh.
No. That was the CIA.
Oh, okay.
No. So back during the Snake War and the start of during this time period, you had the road agent gang, and they were not only they were stealing from stagecoaches, but they were also stealing livestock, and the natives were also blamed for a lot of those livestock thefts. So I have this feeling that some of the stuff that the road agent gangs were doing was blamed on the natives, and that was one of the things that increased the tensions between the natives and led to the Snake War.
Which massacre was it? There were a few maybe smaller massacres, but you know, massacres are massacre, but some of them smaller numbers that white men were actually...
There were several of them. They were involved in the Ward Massacre. They were involved in the Van Orna Mutter Massacre. They were involved in the some of the massacres, the smaller ones over by Massacre Rock State Park, that area. There was Mountain Meadows down in Utah where the Mormons actually were involved.
Hired that tribe to...
That's something else I want to explore.
Yeah, me too. But here's the thing. What's the incentive if there are not that many stories that I know of white men joining the tribes?
Right.
But I don't know how you would even know that. But at the same time, what would be the incentive to the Native Americans to accept them amongst their population? Or it's all white men dressed up as whatever tribe that they're trying to reflect.
Actually, I have a book that you should read. I'll send it home with you tonight.
Okay.
It has some theories in there. So
to add to my pile, but definitely.
Okay, I'll give you the cliff notes. Basically land, you know, if you remove the natives, you have free reign of that land.
Well, yeah, but what would be the impetus for white men to join a group of natives? And how would that even take place?
But join, that's kind of a term you'd have to define, because are they actually living among them, or are they just approaching them and being like, hey, you got to fight these guys, you know?
But that seems
like help a you, you know?
Dangerous proposition.
Of course, yeah. But you start with trade, and then you work up to that.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Jeff, that was super interesting.
I hope so.
And for us, that's lighter fare.
It really is. You know?
Yeah. I'm looking at all our list of podcasts. It's the hanging, the killing, the lynching, racist people, death on the Boise River.
Do we have any on our list that isn't about death?
Idaho Mythbreakers, but you have a spattering of misery and death in that, too.
Oh, yeah. We talk about beaver sickness.
Beaver sickness. That's not... so horrible. Snake River or Snake Indian Wars for two episodes. The trans doctor wasn't too bad, although he had tuberculosis and people dying of horrible infections.
Yeah. We did have an email asking us to cover basically Idaho government and how that has progressed and how that's evolved over the years.
You know what? I guess we could make that interesting.
I think we could, yeah.
Yeah.
Somehow.
It doesn't sound interesting, but...
You know, we're always surprised how much we get into a story. And it's like, oh, this is actually pretty interesting.
I want to start moving to central Idaho and farther north. But this is good stuff.
All right. We'll do that. And if any of our listeners have any suggestions on stories we could do, maybe not so murdery or whatever. Just send them to us.
Yeah, like even the small people that lived in the Owyhees are murderous little creatures.
Cannibals, yeah.
You know?
Like, anyway, yeah. info@idahistory.com. Send them to us and we'll take a look.
Thank you for listening.
All right. We'll talk. What are we doing next time, Mark?
Shoot, I don't think we figured that out.
Okay. We'll figure that out and we'll talk about it next time.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's Counting.